This is Dr. Brian Dixon. I'm a child psychiatrist and CEO of Together Forward, a nonprofit working on solving big social issues for America. I am talking about my book, Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare, How to Lower Costs and Restore Our Collective Sanity. This is a conversation with Dr. Williams on race, violence, and health.
Exactly, race, violence, and medicine. But we're going to roll with it, Dr. Dixon. That'll work. Welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I'm Dr. Brian H. Williams, and today I have an ambitious goal, and that is to solve the healthcare crisis in this country. Now, of course, that is not going to be possible, but I do have, as our guest, the one guy who I think may have a solution, Dr. Brian Dixon. He's a child psychiatrist based in Dallas-Fort Worth, social justice advocate, entrepreneur, speaker, as I said, psychiatrist, and he is author of the book, Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare, Volume 1, How to Lower Costs and Restore Our Collective Sanity. Dr. Dixon, welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine.
Dr. Williams, thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be on, and I'm looking forward to addressing and solving some big problems for the world.
Now, I got to give you credit because in your the title of your book, within, what, half a dozen words, you pick three that will probably inflame every living adult in this country.
Yeah, that was very intentional.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Dixon.
Yeah, so my background, and then and we can totally get back to the title of the book. So my background, so I'm from Deep East Texas, a small town called Lufkin, Texas. Born and raised there, grew up, I'm the baby of five kids, and single-parent household. My mom basically kind of ran the show. My dad was around, but we were blessed that he paid child support and continued to pay attention to us, but it was that didn't make growing up there any easier, but finished there, went to Baylor for undergrad, then Texas A&M for medical school, and then the University of Kentucky for residency, where I did a combined residency in pediatrics and child psychiatry and adult psychiatry. Came back to Texas and worked at a couple different places until I realized that I can't work for anybody else. I need to work for myself. Started a private practice. And that was where I realized that we're overcomplicating this healthcare thing, and so I've been speaking out on it ever since.
I tell you, like, working for yourself, that is, I mean, I'm sure it must be liberating and a goal of many people.
Incredibly liberating, yeah. That was one of the big enlightenment moments of my life is we grew up hearing the mantra, if you work hard, you can have it all, you know, the American dream. Keep working, keep your nose to the grindstone, do your best, and you can have it all. And, I mean, I was working 60, 70, 80 hours and was getting burned out and was very unhappy with things. And so being in control of how I make money has liberated me greatly and then led to this epiphany on how we can restructure healthcare to get everybody taken care of.
And I guess I want to let everybody know that you are African-American male, so you are an example of Black male excellence in medicine. You received several awards, you know, Doctor of the Year awards, featured in the media pretty frequently, lots of podcasts and traditional news outlets. So you're accomplished, you have credibility, and you're a go-to person in your field just because you have performed at the top of your specialty.
Yeah, I'm trying, man. It's a daily struggle. One of the hard parts about being in a situation like us is because of the way that the wealth gap works for African Americans. We just don't make as much money per job or per hour that some of our white male counterparts do, which means that we're already operating at a deficit, which means we have to be twice as good that can burn people out faster. So I'm doing the best I can, and I appreciate men like you who I can walk alongside and who can inspire me to keep pushing.
And that right there is an argument for transparency in compensation in the workplace. But that's another discussion altogether, right? But since we're talking about money, let's get to your books, Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare. Talk about the title, and then let's get into some of the details about the books. I have a few questions I want to ask.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that I learned in marketing, so I didn't learn this in medical school. I learned it from talking to business people and marketing experts, is you want to do something that catches your eye. They call it a lead, L-E-D-E, which is essentially a quick and dirty way of getting someone's attention, because attention is now currency, and it can be bought and sold. And so, so one of the reasons for naming it that book is that people feel pretty strongly about President Obama, and they feel pretty strongly about the person in office now. I say it in the book. I am an unabashed supporter of President Obama. I think he's great. But there was a couple hiccups in his presidency that I think warrant us talking about more, and that is mainly in regards to healthcare and how it's structured. So, yeah, so the name was very purposeful, but at the end of the day, we have to talk about how we actually fund healthcare so that it can be more transparent and more people can access it.
So, you know, going through your book, and I enjoyed the read. It felt like I was sitting there talking to you and not getting a lecture, you know. So the writing was engaging, and I highly recommend the book to anybody out there. It's a quick, informative, funny at times, disheartening at other times, but, you know, very, very good read for anybody that wants to talk about the subject or just likes to read books in general about a variety of topics. So I guess the first question, is it fair to say that the foundation of this debate in this country about healthcare is the question of whether or not healthcare is a right versus a privilege?
Yeah, so that is the question, honestly. It's not the correct question, because it's actually a little bit of both. And I mentioned this in the book, which is having public health is a right. So we know some best practices, you know, wash your hands, drink clean water, breathe clean air, and make those resources as affordable as possible, water, air, food, you know, basic foods, that sort of thing. And those are the foundations of healthcare, of good health. And so, yeah, those to me are a right. We build that into our city ordinances. We build it into our laws. That's a given. What isn't a right and what is a privilege is some of the nifty, neato things that we do. You know, there's certain scans you can do. There's certain procedures that can be done that, for all intents and purposes, those are crafts that people have honed over their years, and people don't have a right to those. You need to pay for it just like you would pay for, a really nice car. So you have the right to walk around and be safe. That is a right that we all have. But to drive around in a Maserati, that's a privilege.
So if I get this correct, you're saying that public health issues are a right. Clean water, if you're washing your hands. But a privilege is having access to the latest technology in healthcare. If I'm getting that right, then I feel that puts me in a bad spot as a doctor. If I'm treating a patient and I feel they need some special CT scan to help diagnose their condition, yet I now have to think about whether or not they can actually afford that and say, well, I need this to diagnose you, but you can't pay for it, therefore you're out of luck.
Yeah, and that's where this is where we have to have a nuanced conversation. So remember back how I said the title of my book was chosen very purposefully to catch attention and get people's eyes, in doing that, you release a lot of dopamine, which is a brain chemical that makes you feel good. Too much of it will make you agitated and really angry. Well, it's that same idea with this argument of rights versus privilege. So in order to have a good conversation about these things, it is a very nuanced conversation. It's going to take time for us to kind of sort through those things, because right now there are people on all sides who are polarizing that issue. And so in your example, what I would say is, yes, if a doctor feels that it is medically necessary, meaning they're putting their malpractice on the line, they're putting their reputation on the line, they're putting their knowledge on the line, then we should make it possible in the marketplace for that scan, for that procedure to be affordable. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be free, because that's the thing that I've learned in my life, and it's and everybody inherently knows this, which is, if you don't pay for something, you don't tend to value it as much. So as a friend of mine always says, if it's free, give me three. And that's not a poverty mindset. That is not a greedy mindset. I think it's just a human mindset. If you don't have to work for something, then absolutely you'll take as many, and then you don't value it as much. And so it needs to be worth something. I think the issue is that right now, so much of healthcare is overpriced because of the way that the market forces work. And so as a result, we don't know how much that scan is. So you're a doctor, you're like, yeah, my patient needs a scan. Well, you have no idea how much it is, because everybody hides their prices, which means that
right.
they can drive up the cost.
And that quote from your friend, if it's free, give it to me, that is used to weaponize how we treat economically disadvantaged patients who are trying to access the healthcare system by
absolutely.
And it's also,
yeah.
But the thing is, people that are at that do have privilege, that do have health insurance, it's the same sort of mentality, right? Because they figure that if they have a job and have health insurance, they still get whatever care they want as long as they're paying their deductible. Everything else above and beyond that should be, in a sense, free.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And so there's been this weird warping of our values, because at the end of the day, every single person that I talk to, I don't care what's in their bank account, and I've worked with patients who are on Medicaid, patients who are uninsured. I've worked with literally all backgrounds, including the wealthy who fly in to see me. And everybody wants to pay for their care, even if it's, hey, I'll give you $10 now, and then we work out a plan, because they're so appreciative. This is an opportunity to have a nuanced conversation about who's truly, truly skewing the finances in healthcare, because it's not the physician. Trust me, every doctor that I've ever run across, they want to be fair, they want to be compensated fairly, but more importantly, they want their patients to feel like they are valued and heard. So if it's not the physician putting their foot on the scale, then who's doing it? Because we're not driving up the cost. And that's a bigger conversation.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because in your book, you devote a chapter to each player in the in healthcare, whether it's pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, the government, physicians, the individual patients. So, like, if you were to pick one in that group, I'm going to put you on the spot here. One within that group that is the most culpable, that needs to change the most, who or what entity would that be?
Yeah, so I'm going to reserve most of my frustration and I'm going to direct it at the individual. And the reason why I say that is that we have...
Wait, is this, are you victim-blaming Dr. Dixon?
No. it will feel that way. And the reason why I say I'm not victim-blaming is because we do not exercise the fundamental maneuver for healthcare, which is your vote. So we have 365, I think, some odd million people in our country. And we have guaranteed the right to vote, and how you vote and when you vote, that determines what we spend our communal money on as a society. And when you don't vote, then, yeah, you don't get a voice. And, yes, I know that there's some extenuating circumstances. Some people can't vote because of felonies and that sort of thing. That's a different podcast for a different day. But at the end of the day, you control what you put in your mouth. You control how much you sleep. For the most part, you control how much you drink and how much exercise you get, and fundamentally, you control how you vote, which then dictates where dollars go, what you're required to spend. So like the Affordable Care Act basically mandated you to spend money on a private commercial product that you can't, whose cost you cannot control. So as a result, the price is going to keep going up because that's how business works. And now we're kind of stuck in that system. And so, yeah, so if I, and it's not vitriol, so I ain't spitting venom at people, but at the end of the day, we are ultimately at fault. Now, all the other players, they ain't making it any easier. Actually, they're going out of their ways to use our neurobiology against us because they keep saying, well, you need health insurance and you need this brand new pill and you need this brand new scan and all this other stuff that drives up the cost of care as well.
Well, you touched on a couple of issues there that would be that we can unpack. Coming to the vote and voter disenfranchisement and how easy it is for certain populations to actually vote. So let's just say for the sake of argument that it was easy for every adult voting age person in this country to cast a vote, that there were no barriers, which we know that there are significant barriers. Say there were no barriers and everyone could vote and they cast their vote. How do you convince them that this is as important as, I don't know, national defense and as important as Supreme Court justices and all those other issues that are floating out there that are sucking up the airwaves, sucking the air out of the room as far as where the direction of the country is going? How do you get them to say, like, you know, healthcare, like, this is important. This matters. Oh, I'm talking, you know, gun violence as well. Toss it in that mix.
Yes. Well, so I feel like I have the best job in the world. I'm super, super lucky because I get to work with people and they tell me things that they don't normally tell other people. So they don't always post this stuff on social media. They don't even tell their neighbor. They tell me some of their deepest, darkest secrets. And one universal that I've run across is that most people are actually pretty reasonable and they're pretty fair. Yeah, there may be some jerks in the group, but generally people want to be treated like they want to treat others like they want to be treated. They want to have safety in their neighborhood, safety for their kids. They want their parents to be taken care of in old age. And so, yes, you're correct. There are significant barriers to voting, but at the core, regardless of whether you vote or not, everybody has that same goal. And so how do we then if I can wave my magic wand and make it all fair, you know, everybody can vote. How do I convince them to, take into account all of those areas that are important? That's where I go back to attention is currency. So what are you watching right now? Because Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, they are quote unquote free. They then dictate what you're seeing. And so part of me says that it would be super, super helpful if we took time to educate people about neurobiology, meaning, hey, they're using your attention against you. So pay attention. And then, on National Election Day where everybody gets off to go vote, then these are the issues that are important. And that includes monitoring gun violence, vaccines, treating your neighbor like they want to be treated, tackling systemic racism, all those things. When people have time to look at them, they're actually fairly reasonable and fair. It's just that our system, so many other systems, economic systems, are keeping that message from being heard.
All right, so we touched upon a few areas of improvement. I'm going to use some positive terminology here.
Yeah.
The individual, you said you, the individual. We talked about the government's role. We've talked about big business's role. Now, give me some advice as a doctor, trauma surgeon, who has chosen to work, in public hospitals. So these are government institutions. These are not private, for-profit entities, and who also has a belief in the inherent right of every human to have access to healthcare, and when the need arises, to get the highest quality care necessary to treat their conditions. Now, my practice and my beliefs are probably in direct contradiction, are in direct opposition to the economic viability of individual institutions. Now, what do I do in that situation? Because you're different, right? You have your own practice. You're getting paid by your clients. My clients come in and they have no insurance or they're underinsured and they're sick and or dying and need treatment. So what advice do you have for someone like me?
Yeah, so it's all in how you set it up. So I'm a firm believer that healthcare is local. So there's nobody in Washington, D.C. that really cares anything about Bobby that I'm treating. They don't care that Bobby has ADHD. They don't care that Susie just got shot and needs a trauma surgeon. So I think healthcare is local. And then it's up to the local. In my proposal, I say you do it on a statewide level. Where you basically make a state joint bank account and you put money in and then you can pull money down from the joint bank account for certain reasons. And that would include some of those emergency situations and or for those people who can't pay. So
break that down some more. Sorry to cut you off. Break that down some more, the state bank accounts. I've read the book, but someone who has not maybe scratching their head right now about what you're, because this is part of your solution, your call to action.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So let's get to this.
Yeah. So the easiest way to understand it, most people are familiar with the model of Sam's Club, or they're familiar with the model of Costco, which is essentially you pay a membership fee, and because you pay a membership fee, you're now bought into the system, and then you can use those monies to drive down the cost of the things that you buy. So essentially, like in Texas, we make a state health company that everybody owns. So because when you're an owner in something, you take ownership of whatever is going on. And so everybody puts money into the company, and then we all agree that the only time you can get money out of that, out of the joint bank account, is if it's unrelated to lifestyle choices. So, you know, cystic fibrosis, sickle cell anemia, neurofibromatosis, those things that we don't have any control over, you can pull money down out of the joint bank account and for those treatments. And for intellectual disabilities and that sort of thing. But then for everything else, you just pay for. And so the secret sauce to all of this working is that it's transparent. So everybody puts in. So that then the people who need it can then pull that money down. And additionally, the piece de resistance is that I advocate for getting rid of the nonprofit status for churches and for hospitals, and for every dollar of healthcare that they cover on behalf of someone else, they get their tax deduction or their tax write-off that way. And that way, they are then incentivized to take care of those folks who cannot pay for it. And it builds accountability within communities because, again, hospitals and churches are local things. And so, it probably won't be very popular, but at the end of the day, we have to find a mechanism to pay for health care, but the only way to make it cheaper is through transparency.
So basically, each state would have their own health care bank account that's jointly owned by every citizen of that state. We all put in to that based on our income.
So that's an excellent question. So this is where I would love to lead some national conversations because I think I'm pretty good at mental health. There's some economics and actuarial stuff that I would love to get some input from those folks. But I wouldn't base it on income. We are a nation of fairness, and everybody likes things to be fair. So in this case, I would do a flat rate so that when you create your state-based company, you're going to have leadership that's elected by all the shareholders, so all 27 million Texans or whoever, however many there are of us. And then they can then set the yearly amount. So if it's $500 or $1,000 or $1,500 or whatever it is, everybody pays that into the company. And then if they can't pay for it again, you can go and leverage sponsorship from hospitals and churches. So that then everybody feels that it's fair. And on the flip side, people hate, especially Americans, we hate being mandated to do anything. And so this is completely optional. So if you don't want to pay into the system, great, don't pay into the system. But if you don't pay into the system, you don't get the benefits of that system. And the biggest benefit being that when you have a multi-billion-dollar company, so the Texas healthcare company, they can then go and buy their medicines and sponsor research in bulk. So if you don't buy into the, if you don't pay your Costco fee, if you try to go into Costco, they're going to look at you and be like, what you doing? You can't come in here. And it's going to be the same thing. So now you're incentivized to go ahead and buy into the system. But again, you can choose not to, but that's, that means that it's on you to find your own medicines and find your own, you know, research dollars.
All right, Dr. Dixon, that just leads me to another question.
Yeah.
That's particularly pertinent in Texas, where a large number of my patients were not citizens or they were undocumented. Is the expectation that I need to turn them away at the door?
Oh, my God, no. And this is one of the things that infuriates me, because at the end of the day, we're all human. So I don't care where you come from. I don't care what documentation you have. We're all human. And my plan, my idea is citizenship neutral, meaning if you can't afford, not if you can't afford, if you are undocumented from whatever capacity, whether you're a European person and you overstay your visa, whether you're from Guatemala and you're escaping violence, you can go see a doctor because your doctor will post their fees online. Hey, here's $65 for a well-woman exam. This is an opportunity for physician entrepreneurs to get into this space, and there will be people who will gladly create a market and cater to certain populations. Of course, discrimination is not allowed in any business, of course, but this is a great opportunity to get rid of all the barriers to care, so that now, regardless of your citizenship status, you're now able to get whatever care you need.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Brian Dixon, author of the book Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare, child psychiatrist, entrepreneur, speaker, social justice advocate based in Dallas-Fort Worth. We're going to take a quick break. Dr. Dixon, when I come back, we're going to talk about, you say that the kids are the entry point, the first step into making your plan become a reality. I want to talk about that, and also I want to get your advice about some issues I've been having with my daughter in relation to gun violence. So I'm going to tap into your child psychiatry expertise and get a free consultation, if that's okay.
Sounds good.
All right. Stick with us. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I'm Dr. Brian Williams, and we are here today with Dr. Brian Dixon, author of the book Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare. He has a plan to fix the healthcare crisis in this country. And Dr. Dixon, fascinating discussion so far. In the book, you talk about kids as being an important part to making your plan go forward and be successful. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, so I have a saying. I got the honor of training as a pediatrician, and I just love working with kids. And I have a saying that people will always take care of their kids and their cars, but they don't always take care of themselves, meaning adults don't always take care of themselves. And so we are a very highly motivated society to take care of children for the most part. And so in introducing my idea and implementing the idea, I was like, how do we introduce this in a way that's fair? Well, we have a population of people who cannot vote, who cannot go get jobs, and with whom it is in our best interest to make sure that we take care of, which are our children. It was a natural fit to say, okay, let's start with kids first and create the funding scheme and incorporate kids so that we are incentivized to keep them healthy. And then as we work out the operational kinks of switching from one system to another, slowly adding more people. So that's where the idea of starting with kids came from, because generally most people are and even politicians want to help children. And then we build on the infrastructure from there.
So we talked a lot about, the theory, the principles of your plan. What about the economics? I'll freely admit that these numbers get so big that they're even hard to fathom what they mean. But to an economist that does this all the time, like, what would your answer to be to them is like how this will, as far as the financial impact on the country? there's obvious health benefits, right? Obvious health benefits, you know, all those things like that. But as far as the financial impact, where does that leave us?
Yeah, so one of the great parts about the economics is it's on its face, it's pretty straightforward. So I think maybe the Kauffman Family Foundation recently said, I think we spend $10,000 a person on healthcare. And a total of $3.5 trillion, which you're right, I can't get my head around that either. But so let's say $10,000 per person. Well, most of us most of us probably have employer-based health insurance. And so imagine when we have a transparent and clear marketplace, you pay your $1,000, $1,500 for the year to be part of your state health company. And then that means you no longer need to pay into Medicare. And so you will then get to keep all of the Medicare contributions that you're given. You will also keep all of your employer-based insurance premiums, so that $30 a month or whatever, or for some people, $200 a month that you're putting into insurance, you get to keep that too. So a huge chunk of money is now in your pocket. Now you're more incentivized to stay healthy. So you'll start, you know, walking around and eating that oatmeal. You can buy care if you need it. So you can go to CareNow or any physician-led urgent care practice is where I'm hoping people will go. And then you also have that even more money now to invest in your schools. You have more money to invest in your roads. You have more money to invest in crowdfunding and research and the whole nine yards. And so so on its face right now, just think about it as a – just your normal budget. Right now, your money goes into a pot, and you don't ever see it again. It, like, literally disappears. It goes to Blue Cross Blue Shield or Aetna, and you never get it back.
Yep.
This is just an opportunity. You just keep it in your pocket, and you pay your fee, and then we move on with life.
Well, Dr. Dixon, I think we need to get you on some national task force to get these ideas heard, how to move
Brian,
the shakers that make these kind of things happen.
Yeah, well, so Dr. Williams, I have tried. I have emailed politicians on the right and left. I've donated to campaigns on the right and left. I've donated to think tanks that are conservative and liberal. Nobody listens. It's not in their interest to listen because I'm one lonely black guy in Fort Worth, and I don't have the clout or the economic power to make a difference on that level. So I'm just going to keep screaming. And we'll see what happens.
Well, definitely do not stop. But I want to get to our last thing, and this is going to touch upon an issue that is pretty much part of my daily life, which is gun violence. As a trauma surgeon, every single day, that's just something that is part of my reality. It's also a part of the reality of, you know, victims and their families and loved ones who are impacted by gun violence. The ripple effects are like, they're indescribable. However, what's happening now in schools with the active shooter drills that are, you know, they're pretty much a regular part of a child's existence hit home for me a few weeks ago when my daughter woke up screaming with a nightmare. And to get to the point, that day they had an active shooter drill at school, and she was dreaming about the bad man with the gun coming to get her. So, I mean, I was infuriated because that's her reality, but also felt helpless because I could do nothing about it. This is a dream, and this is the world we live in nowadays. I just went to a little bit of a Twitter discussion with me on Twitter and some of my friends and colleagues, and you piped in and said that you were seeing an increase in the number of kids that are impacted by these active shooter drills in your practice. Tell us more about that and what sort of advice do you have for parents as far as having discussions about this, whether you are pro-gun or anti-gun. It's not about that. This is a discussion about what can we as parents do what's best for our children. I think that everyone can agree what we want our kids to be happy, healthy, and feel safe.
Yes. One of the takeaways that I hope every one of your listeners has is that trauma begets trauma, meaning if you go through a trauma and you don't tackle it, you're going to then pass that on to other people. And in this case, our children, our collective children. So
my wife says it all the time. She says it all the time. You've been talking to her. Trauma begets trauma. Okay.
It does. It really, really does. And so we as a nation need to, from the front end, tackle that part. If you want to own a gun as your Second Amendment right, well, then just store it safely. Put it in places where your kiddos can't get it, and then make sure that your kiddos and your family are having their mental health needs taken care of. Go see a therapist. I always say every person in America should have a therapist. Why? Because we're all terrible therapists for ourselves, because we're too close to ourselves to be objective. So don't try to do self-therapy. It is really tough. So go talk to somebody. So on the front end,
I'm not buying that. I'm perfect. I'm not buying that, Dr. Dixon. I'm doing fine.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm joking.
So they're not. Yeah. So see your therapist, and then vote in those people who have your best interest at heart. In other words, if you have that right to vote, go and exercise that right to vote. So so there's that on the front end. Now on the back end, what to do when your kid has already been traumatized. So one of the most important things is to build structure into their life and their understanding. So kids get their concept of the universe from their parents and what they're seeing and what they're seeing around them and then their friends. And so be very mindful of what you have on your TV. Make sure you are watching what they're seeing on YouTube and social media. And if that means turn it off, then turn it off. Let them go play, go outside, make mud pies, do all the stuff that we used to do back in the day. And then when you're talking to them, so the key to managing anxiety, the key to managing trauma when you're talking with kiddos is never overemphasize things. Be very kind of straightforward. Hey, this is what the school is asking to do. We're working to change that for right now. Just listen to your teachers and just know that you are safe and loved as long, as you're here, as long as I'm here. I'm going to make sure to take care of you. When it comes to processing past that, so I tell all of my parents, because I'm a child psychiatrist and I love working with families, I always tell my parents that they are terrible therapists for their kids. And so if you are in a situation where your kid, especially if they're really bright and they're asking hard questions, they are watching every movement, every bit of energy that you're giving them. So if you get real ticked off and you start becoming irate and, you know, we need to work on this and, you know, why won't people get their act together? Well, if you're doing that, you're adding anxiety to your child, and it's only going to make it worse, because remember, trauma begets trauma.
And right, so right.
Yeah, so that's the opportunity. Even though you may be well-meaning, that's the opportunity you go, you know, well, that's a really good question. Let's go talk to, you know, Miss Susie and, or Miss Jane and see what she has to say. And then through different types of therapy, sometimes it's play therapy, sometimes it's talk therapy, sometimes it's behavioral therapy, that unattached person, that unattached therapist can then walk your kiddo through some things so that then they feel very safe and secure. They feel equipped with coping skills. And then they come back home to you, and again, you stay super structured, and then that will essentially treat the trauma. Sometimes we need to do medicines, but it's just dependent on the kid. So yeah, we tackle it from the front end, we tackle it from the back end, from the top, from the bottom, and hopefully we can get your little one even better soon.
Now, would that advice apply to, you know, all pediatric patients? Like, I'm talking about my young daughter, right? But for a preteen or a teenager, would you change any kind of advice what you just gave?
Yeah, so it's all the same basic advice. The only thing about teenagers that are different than pre-adolescents is that teenagers are wonderful. Don't get me wrong, and I love every teenager I work with. That's my disclaimer. As they become teenagers, they become even more egocentric, meaning they put themselves in the middle of the universe and everything revolves around them. And so that can cause lots of powerlessness if you're not careful. But the other thing is teenagers, since they think they're the smartest person in the room, they are really not designed to listen to their parents, even though y'all have all the right answers. And so that's where getting them in groups of other teens, like leading group conversations with teenagers, is super helpful, because they can help each other in so many ways that is powerful. Of course, you just need to make sure you have a really good facilitator, a really good therapist, or somebody that can run those groups. Teens are slightly different than younger kids, but the premise is still the same. They still want structure. They still want predictability. Make sure to limit their exposure to electronics and social media. I think the American Academy of Pediatrics says 2 hours of screen time total in a day. So I live by that rule.
Well, if you're saying that teenagers are egocentric and the university revolves around them, then I can tell you, I know a few people I work with in the field of trauma that can use a child psychiatrist.
Absolutely, yeah. Some people don't operate their egocentrism sometimes. We hope they do.
Yeah. So, Dr. Dixon, thank you very much for being on the show and sharing your story and insight with my audience. If they want to contact you after the show, where would you direct them?
Yeah, so the best place to go is actually my website. It's Brian, B-R-I-A-N, at drbriandixon.com, drbriandixon.com. If you email me through there, if you contact me through there, it all comes straight to me. So voila, you can get a one-person audience with me. The other place to find me, I'm on Twitter. My handle is dr. Dixon, D-I-X-O-N-F-T-W. And so I like to tweet. I'm one of those folks where I always believe in being cordial because that's what my mama taught me. In all things you do, be nice. And so I will always be nice. But if you want to act a fool, you will be blocked and muted. But you can always send me an email if you want to have intelligent conversation that moves the conversation forward.
So your website is a way to contact you for setting up an appointment, but also if they want to find out about your book or find out have you come speak, is that correct? It's a one-stop shopping? Okay.
Yeah, it is one-stop shopping. Yeah, I have a great marketing team. And so, yeah, www.drbriandixon.com is the website, or you can email me directly in all of my bio and speaking stuff. Yeah, it's all on the website. So please reach out if you have any questions.
Perfect. Dr. Dixon, author of the book, Forget Obama, Trump Ignored Healthcare, speaker, child psychiatrist. Thanks for being on the show. Appreciate it. Check out his book. You can get it on Amazon and anywhere else. I got it on Amazon, I'm sure. Wait a second, you sent me the book. You sent me a copy of the book.
Yeah.
But it is available on Amazon.
I can send you a book. Once you buy it on Amazon, the goal is to get it into the hands of every American. So let's get it cracking.
All right. And I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, your host for Race, Violence, and Medicine. And I know you're listening to this show, but your family and friends and colleagues may not even know it exists. So I ask you, please share it with them. It is available on pretty much every single platform out there. It's Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor FM, you name it, it is there. If you want to reach out to me, check out my website, brianwilliamsmd.com. That's B-R-I-A-N, williamsmd.com. And I am active on Twitter at BHWilliamsMD. Hit me up there, and I will get back to you. Thank you all for tuning in. I want to wish you all peace.